And we're ready for the second lecture, which is on your program, is called Information and Life. So, let me pause. Any question that can't wait? Okay, then we'll go on. Yes? Well, there's some, but in fact, they were discouraged from doing that. But there's some interesting meme lore that did propagate. And I can't remember the details, but some of them thought they were, I think, making some sort of super fabric that would be used as, you know, bulletproof fabric or something. I mean, it was all kinds of crazy stuff they thought. But they really didn't know, and there's some funny stories about it, but that'll have to wait for another time.
Then what is also very interesting to think about what you were saying is what is needed for a common into the economy, and how much information or what has to be the links between individuals as related to the origin of municipal
money. Yes. Yeah. We actually, I had a slide that looked at that issue. And looked at slime molds and Volvox and so forth. I didn't go into the details, but you're exactly right. That was in the first lecture, actually. Yeah. So when people think about information today, they tend to think about bits and bytes and megabytes and bandwidth. But there's other senses of information which are rather different. We just talk about news or science or history, not necessarily measured in information theoretic terms, or communication, or things like trade secrets, patents, and copyrights. Now, these are separable ideas about information. They're separable in principle, but it's becoming harder and harder to separate them in practice. And what I want to do now is try to at least create in your minds, if you don't already have it, a little alarm system that warns you that when people talk about information, it's not always Shannon information theory information at all. And what has happened is in cognitive science, cognitive neuroscience, everybody talks about information processing in the brain, and they think they're entitled to do that because we have this wonderful mathematical theory of information. That's not what they're talking about. The mathematical theory of information has only a tangential use. It is not the foundation for informational talk in cognitive science. What is? Don't ask. We haven't worked it out yet. But we think it's okay, and I think we're right to think it's okay. And what I'm trying to do is to say what the sense of information is, sketch what the sense of information is that isn't the Shannon sense. So, here we go. We're living in the information age. Well, which age is that? Is it the age of Turing or the age of history when we had writing and so we could distinguish it from prehistory where we don't have written records? Is the age of communication? That takes us back to the birth of language or maybe before that, back to bird song and animal communication. Or the age of life itself. And in effect, there's a good claim to make that life itself is an informational phenomenon, that you can't make sense of the simplest bacterium without bringing in a concept of information. But that's not Shannon information. Or if it is, it's only very indirectly Shannon Weaver mathematical theory of information. So, let's look at some things made of information. Now notice, well, I know I put made of information in scare quotes. I could have put things in scare quotes too. Remember sellers, things in the broadest possible sense and how they hang together in the broadest possible sense. So now here are some things made of information. And look how familiar they are, poems, Poems aren't made of ink or of acoustic waves. They're made of words, songs, equations, recipes, maps, methods, ways of doing things, algorithms, genes. Aren't genes made of DNA? Some people say so. I say no, George Williams was right. Genes are made of information. The DNA is to the genes as the ink is to the poem. It's a vehicle for information, but the information, the genes are the information, not the DNA. Here's a little thought experiment to help you see how that might be true. This is my little fable about Herb and Alice and Hal. So Herb and Alice want a child, but they don't, for reasons I can't imagine, want to do it the old-fashioned way. So they get their genomes sequenced. So they each get an ACGT file, 3 billion codons long, and they use a random selection algorithm to make an offspring genome, running a little from grandpa and a little from grandma, I mean a little from the other grandpa, and so forth. So they do the meiotic routine. And then once they put it together to make an offspring genome, which they send to Craig Venter's lab, and he uses this as a file to generate an actual DNA copy for the first time. So this is the opposite of having your genome sequenced. It's going from a sequence. They've had their genome sequenced. Then they've mixed their genomes in the way nature mixes our genomes with the egg and the sperm, and now they send it back to Venter, who creates in the lab the DNA to their specification, to their recipe, which is then implanted, and if it matters to you, it can be in the ovum of Alice, or it can be a surrogate mother, it doesn't matter. It matters for many things, but it doesn't really matter. Eventually, it can be in a surrogate mother, and eventually baby Hal is born. Question, who are the parents of Hal? Obvious answer, Herb and Alice. Hal passes every test for being the offspring of Herb and Alice that would be used in a court of law. DNA fingerprinting, Hal is the child of Herb and Alice, and the relationship is not the usual one, because it goes via a merely informational link. If you want to heighten that, you can imagine that once they've got the file, it is sent by satellite to Venter's lab. So the information has been transmitted reliably, but no matter enters into the creation of Hal that was part of Herb and Alice, and yet Hal is their child. That's what Williams was getting at when he said the information, genes are information, not DNA. DNA is just like the ink. So now my claim is that evolution and other quasi-evolutionary processes, remember Peter Godfrey Smith and the fact that there are processes which are largely evolutionary but not entirely, utilize information to create ever more intelligent designs, enabling us and only us eventually to comprehend the processes that create us. So that's a sort of takeaway message of the whole story I'm trying to spell out. Shannon Weaver, mathematical theory of information is where we get bits, bytes, bandwidth, and so forth. And it is, of course, very foundational to computer science and to the digital world in which we live. And it's not the concept of information I'm talking about here. Putting the different senses of information together is tricky. Darwinian and quasi-Darwinian processes generated things with parts that are the way they are for reasons, those are the free-floating rationales, designed things created by mindless, purposeless R&D in a process marked by a principle. The fundamental R&D principle of evolution is, if it works, copy it. In other words, this is evolution as the universal patent infringement or plagiarism. If it works, copy it. What's nice about this is it gives us a perspective on Shannon information, on mathematical information theory, bits and bytes and binary. Why? Because information is valuable. It's worth stealing. It's worth copying. Why? Because it's information. More about that in a minute. But if it's valuable, you want to keep track of it, and you don't want it to decay. You don't want it to get lost in noise, and that's where Shannon theory comes in. Do you play the game of 20 questions ever? That's an American English. It used to be a radio program in my youth. One person thinks of something, anything, of any variety. Broad, and all you tell your questioners is a sort of preposterous, it was animal, vegetable, or mineral were the three categories, and you said one of those. Notice that we're already off on a bad foot because many of the things on made of information are not animal, vegetable, or mineral. What's a poem? it's informational. Should have been animal, mineral, or informational, or something like that. Living material or informational. But at any rate, the game of 20 questions, you're allowed to ask 20 questions which have yes, no answers. And the thing is, can you zero down and get the answer in only 20 questions? It's an interesting strategic game. Think of how you do it. And this idea of 20 questions is at the heart of information. What a bit is an answer to a yes-no question. So here's Claude Shannon, and I chose the picture carefully. It's a 2.5 megabyte JPEG. In other words, it's the answer to a game of 20 million questions. Each dot, yes or no, is either white or black, and that'll give you this picture by just asking again and again, is it white? Yes. Next one. Is it white? No. Next one. Is it white? Yes. You do that 20 million times and you get this picture. The set of all possible black and white pictures is the set of 2 megabyte size, is the set of all possible answers to the game of 20 questions. That is the fundamental bit, and that's where we get the bit, the zero or one. So Shannon's simplification was to think of information transmission as a channel between a sender and a receiver. And a quantitative measure of channel capacity. This is like, how much water can you put down this pipe? And if you've got an answer, you also know how much gasoline or orange juice or milk can go down that pipe. It's a measure of channel capacity, not the content in any other sense. It's independent of meaning or aboutness. Now notice that Shannon, his brilliant simplification was almost the reverse of Turing's. He put agents in the sender and receiver spot and then said, we're not going to look at them. But they have to be assumed really to be comprehending, to be able to agree on a code. and to be inquisitive. And the sender's job is to send a message that the receiver can decode and understand. So Shannon just wants to look at the channel. So like Turing, he simplifies, and there's no understanding in the channel, but that's because we're to understand, and it's outside the picture, that the sender and receiver are themselves agents. So, well, information is valuable, but if you want to explain how there comes to be agents, that's how come sense of why, we've got to expel them from our picture because they're presupposed in Shannon's picture and use a different concept of information. Roughly the economic concept of information, where information is something worth working for, something worth paying for, something that is valuable in your personal economy if you're an organism. Information is a valuable design element. And then we can begin to look at evolution as R&T, which generates information in this sense. Now, I'm going swiftly over something which needs a slower development, but I want to get the general sketch of the position out. And so I'm going to talk about industrial espionage, which is a nice way of looking at this. So this is how to steal a secret. Here we have a widget. Well, actually, I don't know what it is. I just got a picture of a weird, difficult-looking thing off the internet. And we'll call it, with tradition, we'll call it a widget. And this is the new widget that the Acme Strombolizer company has put into their strombolizer. And General Strombolizer wants to copy it, wants to steal the design. So they need to get a spy into the Acme company to get the information about how to make the widget. So they succeed. Let's say you are hired and you get hired by, you're hired by General Strombolizer, and you then go get a job at Acme Strombolizer, and pretty soon you've got yourself access to one of these widgets. Now the trick is how to get the information out so you can get paid for your theft. Well, you could do a drawing or a photograph or a blueprint. Or maybe you're going to make a plaster cast piece mold, which will be a negative from which they can then make a positive. Or maybe you'll make a copy in any material. You carve it out of a bar of soap. Or you simply, heroically, memorize a description of the thing in words that you compose. You don't trust it to pen and paper. You just memorize it and you keep it in your head. You just walk out the door and you carry the information with you. Here's a lovely way to do it. Get a CAD/CAM file for a 3D printer and put that file on a little miniature USB stick. It's going to be a gigantic file, but never mind. You can put it on your USB stick. I don't know, maybe you swallow it. You walk out the door. These are all ways of getting the information about the widget from A to B. The last one, for sure, we can measure in Shannon information how many bits it is. What's the file size? You can't do that for the plaster cast, really, or the soap replica. And of course, there's another way of doing it. Borrow a widget, take it out, return it. You haven't stolen a widget, but you've stolen the information, which your employer, your real employer, can extract any way they want once they've got the widget in their own hands. So these are all ways of getting information in the sense I'm interested in, I want to concentrate on, from point A to point B, and only some of them involve Shannon information. Although we can often express what's going on in terms of Shannon information along the lines of the CAD-CAM file. Or the memorized description in words, yeah, put it into ASCII and measure it in bits, just like an email or a Word file. But I wanted to show you how many ways there are for getting information from point A to point B that don't involve codes. Because we tend to think of information nowadays in terms of encodings. And I want to suggest that that's not necessary. And that most of the information generation in this world has not been encoded, although encoding is involved in making it possible, namely DNA. But that's part of the story that we want to keep distinct from the information that the DNA encodes. Both the genes, that's one encoding, and then we want to talk about the information that makes genetic encoding valuable, which is information about phenotypic design. Hint, maybe we can learn what information is by looking at the word information. Form. It's information about the form of something. It's Aristotle's formal cause or close to it. And then we think that, in a way, all learning, which is acquiring information, is a case of redesign. Taking the design you have now and tampering with it somehow in virtue of information that you pull out of the world via your sense organs, from your experience. Learning. See, we want to distinguish learning from other tamperings that happen to your body. If somebody drives a fork through your skull and changes your brain, that's not learning. That's probably damage. If you take ecstasy and fry your cortex, that changes your brain, but it isn't learning, alas. Learning is, how do we distinguish learning from scarring and other ways of changing the form of something, bruising, scarring? How do we distinguish it as a category of change wrought by interaction with the environment? We say learning is design improvement wrought by a system which gently and appositely, appropriately tweaks, changes the design you have into a new design that benefits you in the long run. That's a rough approximation of what learning is as a subclass. Of course, there's such thing as too much learning, learning things that you don't really need to know, and that is itself an important concept. But the only reason there's learning that's too much learning and there's learning you don't need to know is that your learning systems can be exploited by things that are in competition with you for your interests. And they can fill your head with spam, for instance, or other junk that comes along for free, comes along riding on the design that was designed to improve your design and doesn't. One of the fundamental principles we learn from game theory is, whoop, we pushed the wrong direction. Don't give away your design. Keep your design secret. You want to have a poker face. If you reveal everything about your design, the other entities in the world that are capable of acting intelligently don't have to treat you as a fellow agent. They can treat you as a thing, as a money pump, if they like, because they have enough of an understanding of your design so they can predict your every move. You play the game of rock, paper, and scissors. Suppose you play it for money. You want to keep your next move secret from your opponent. Right there in that crux, I think we see the inspiration, and I would say the misinspiration, for the idea that free will involves indeterminism. If indeterminism is true, then even God can't predict what your move is going to be. And I have conceded to some of my critics on free will that I now see there is one condition under which I would prefer indeterminism to be true, because it would benefit my free will, and that is if I ever find myself playing rock, paper, and scissors for high stakes with God. Otherwise, I have no need for indeterminism. Be intelligent, we have to be able to keep our counsel, we have to be able to keep secrets. The March issue of Scientific American, I don't know if you get that here. There is a piece that I wrote with Deb Roy called Our Transparent Future, which suggests that we're about to lose our membranes. Every human organization is at risk of losing its membrane because of the new transparency brought about by the internet and cell phones and the social media and so forth. And Edward Snowden and Julian Assange are just the canaries in the coal mine. There's much more of this to come. And every organization in the world, the Roman Catholic Church, the CIA, General Motors, Sony, you, we're all in danger of a sort of catastrophic loss of membrane that we weren't evolutionarily designed to live with. We were designed to live in a more murky epistemological environment, and so were our institutions. And the principles of secret keeping that worked in Oak Ridge aren't going to work anymore. And that's not really good news, even though part of it is good news. I think some of it's very good news, but some of it is also very, very worrying. So that's in Scientific American last month, Our Transparent Future. It's on my website. It's on Deb Roy's website. It's readily available online. Okay, back to our comparison between the termite and Gaudí. Colony de Gaudí is given by my friend Bo Dalbum in a wonderful line. He says, you can't do much carpentry with your bare hands, and you can't do much thinking with your bare brain. A termite colony is a bare brain, and so is a wolf's brain, and so is a dolphin's brain. Gaudí had a well-equipped brain, lots of thinking tools, most of which he didn't make for himself. He acquired them from his culture. He acquired them from his language. He acquired them from his culture. And culture is itself subject to evolution and has its own evolutionary history, which is going to be the main topic of the rest of the lectures. So the long answer is that cultural evolution designed thinking tools that impose novel structures on our brain. They are, in fact, evolved virtual machines. You have a cell phone. It's got a Turing machine. It's got a Turing hardware on the chip. That's the basic CPU. It has the competence to do arithmetic and conditional branching. That's it. Everything else is virtual machine, piled on virtual machine, Operating systems, programs that run on them. And our brains are the hardware on which a similar cascade power hierarchy of virtual machines can be imposed. That's what we're going to be discussing tomorrow and on Friday, how these virtual machines evolved and how we install them on our brains. They're not, unlike the virtual machines on your cell phone, they're not files of bit strings, but they're informational things. They're just not bit strings files. They're not things that can be readily measured in Shannon terms. There are things like, I'll give you just one example of a virtual machine that is installed in every one of your brains. First of all, one of the virtual machines that you have on your computer and on your laptop and on your cell phone is the JVM, the Java Virtual Machine. It's what permits you to download and use Java programs without even knowing about it. The Java Virtual Machine is basically transparent to you. You don't know it's on your laptop, but it is. Every time you go on the internet, just about, your Java Virtual Machine is used to run a little code on your laptop. And the thing, I'm getting ahead of myself, I should stop right here, but just a little bit more. Because you have the JVM, you can run programs that are written by people that have no idea what kind of a computer you have. It'll run on a Mac, it'll run on a PC, it'll run on a Unix machine, it'll run on any cell phone. That's the virtue of Java, is that it is a hardware-neutral way of making apps. Here's another hardware-neutral way of making apps and spreading them. Install on people the EVM. That's the English virtual machine. Or the SVM, that's the Spanish virtual machine. Or the CVM, that's the Catalan virtual machine. What am I doing? What have I been doing for the last few days? I've been installing apps in your necktops via the English virtual machine. And I don't have to know the details of the hardware. All the differences in your different brains don't matter, because of this brilliant invention of the EVM, which permits me to install thinking tools in your brains which then permit you to comprehend things that you didn't understand before. And looking at the details of those processes and how they evolved is what the rest of these lectures are going to be about. Thanks.
Thank you, Dan. I was reminded of one of your earlier lectures in which you made the analogy between the origin of life and the origin of cell phones, and where we should stop thinking as the origin of life as hyper simple, but as a complex, clunky machine, and that through evolution we pare it down. Here it looks like you're going in the other direction, in which you use our technological innovations to help us. Well, in a way, it's a similar strategy. You're using our technological innovations to help us think about how the biological might have evolved. But while I think parsimony is an important intellectual virtue, I wonder if nature always will use the same good trick that we independently, after hard work, seem to discover too. And now clearly nature is often our example in discovering these good tricks, but I worry that you're going to end up in a position where there's this beautiful morphism between our technological evolution and natural evolution. And what looked like metaphors are now being taken almost, well, literally, whatever it means. If I were a Martian coming down and see Dena do this, I'd be like, ha, he's taking local technology and projecting it onto nature. He's just being parochial. Isn't that the kind of a concern here that sort of ought to be discussed?
Yes, it is. But I think the time to discuss it is after we have a few details about how I'm going to do this and see if it looks all that broken. Absolutely right. I am deeply cognizant of and sensitive to the amusing historical observation that every time a new technology comes along, it gets used as the analogy of the
brain. We had steam engine brains and telephone exchange operator brains, and we had even I forget what those Pribram went wild for. Hologram brains and computer brains, and now we got Java virtual machines and apps and cell phones, right? And I realize that I am undaunted, persisting in a tradition which is looking more and more comical. That does justice to your worry, I think. But as I say, I'm undaunted. I think we're getting better and better at this trick. We learn from our mistakes with the steam engine and the telephone switchboard and the hologram. And we're making more and more progress because we're getting clearer and clearer about what the underlying job of a nervous system is. The trouble with the telephone switchboard was that it still had the darn telephone operator there. It was the homunculus, all-knowing, was still there in the driver's seat, and that was no good. And thanks to Turing, we've begun to realize how we can begin to eliminate that middleman or middlewoman and get the job done with uncomprehending competences. So the idea that heretofore Let me put it in some historical terms. Descartes famously considered the possibility of AI in a passage in the Discourse on Method. And he said, yes, he could imagine a machine that could be made that was designed to answer a few questions, or you tap it here and it says, don't do that, or that hurts. Or he said, yeah, he could imagine making an automaton that could do some pretty cute tricks, but, he said, could never respond to the near infinity of language the way even, you know, a stupid person can do. So he sort of invented the Turing test right there, and the question is whether Turing ever really was inspired by Descartes' example of a machine that you could have a pseudo-conversation with. What does Descartes do, having imagined this? He says, but no machine could ever, ever have a conversation. And that was, in fact, really his best argument for dualism. And if you think about it, I've thought a lot about it, but maybe not enough. I think this is a classic example of the philosopher's foible of mistaking a failure of imagination for an insight into necessity. Here's what I think went on in Descartes' mind. It's very impertinent and rude of me to do this. I'm going to imagine what went on in his mind, although he never expressed it. He said, let's see, is that true? Could an automaton hold a conversation? Well, it could, you know, it could do a few sentences, maybe 100, maybe 1,000. Let's see, could it? Well, suppose we had a machine with 1,000, let's make it 1,000,000 gears, and 10 miles, 50 miles of wire and pulleys, and 10,000 ratchets. Nah, that couldn't hold a conversation, and he'd be right. What he had no way of taking seriously was a machine with 1,000,000,000,000 moving parts. That's what we have between our ears. He just had no way of taking that seriously. What Turing has given us for the first time is a disciplined way of thinking seriously about machines with trillions of moving parts. And we don't have it just right yet, but we're not foolish to think that in the space of possibilities opened up by the perspective of computers, there are lots of competences that will amaze us and are amazing us. And of course, if you took your cell phone in the time machine back and showed it to somebody in Descartes' age, they would be absolutely sure that there was, you know, this was magic. It's not. It's wonderfully not magic. We know exactly how these things work. One of the great things about computers is there's no cards up the sleeve. We know the causation from the ground up. And so we have a wonderful tool for exploring possibilities that was not available before. And so what I will be arguing is that the computer we've got between our brains, between our ears, is made of neurons. It's very, very different from a silicon chip computer, but it's still a computer. And we still can make sense of the software that can be downloaded on it. But I'm going to try to put that in enough detail so that you at least have a fairly meaty hypothesis to wonder about. Anyway, that's where it's going.
Yeah. My question is related to something that in science fiction has been discussed a lot, and it's very simple. To which extent in this intelligent design is possible that nobody really understands what's going on, in the sense that the complexity is so huge that our understanding is not complete. And, for example, how many people understand your computer here in the world?
Yeah.
Not many.
Yeah.
And maybe in a macro computer, nobody is already understanding that. To which extent this is going to change our vision?
You have just, you've just given away my punchline. you're ahead of me. The title of these lectures is From Bacteria to Bach and Back. And the last lecture will be about what I call the age of post-intelligent design. And that's just what the topic is going to be. How our very intelligence is giving us thinking tools that we have very good reason to trust, even though we can't understand how they work. And that's a prospect with some very unsettling implications. And responsibility. Oh, absolutely right. And I'm not talking about free will and responsibility here, not tonight and not this week, but on Monday in Barcelona, that's exactly what I'll be talking about. And I'll be talking in particular about free will as moral competence. And the relationship of that to comprehension, and the relationship of that to determinism in the brain, and so forth. So you're right. This is, and you may remember that I said in the first lecture when I introduced my metaphor of Cartesian gravity, the distorting force, the thing that often prevents people from taking the sort of line that I'm developing is they're sure that it's going to leave out free will. It's going to leave out responsibility, that they have to preserve some inner sanctum of the mind, which is proof against all science, because if science gets in there, then no free will, and then life has no meaning and no responsibility. And I understand that's a very powerful motive, but I'm trying to disarm that motive and say, you know, wait till you see, wait till you see. We can get all the way to moral responsibility, building up from the Turing bricks. We can get all the way there, building competence on competence on competence. But there's a lot of anxiety about that. I first learned this when I published Consciousness Explained, and I talked it over then with a lot of neuroscientists and a lot of psychologists, people, you know, devoting their lives to the very issues that I was exploring in that book. And I run into, you know, pockets of resistance, which I would then probe. We'd have a long conversation, and they would, you know, back up. Okay, I can see. And again, it would come back to, yeah, but what about free will? And I began to realize that this was a sort of hidden agenda motivating a lot of their thought about how the theory had to run. And since they had this dark suspicion that there was no way of salvaging moral responsibility if we continued down this path, their instinct was, and instinct is really the right word, was cut it off as early as possible. Let's just not tolerate this research agenda because it's bound to come up with something awful. And that's Cartesian gravity.
My question is about machines or computers and learning. I'm not an expert in computers, I'm not an expert in computers, but I think there has been big improvements in the computers learning. No, and so how is the technology today in this field in computers? Can computers or machine redesign and then improve? And how, if you have, you are explaining layers and layers of competence, no? I don't know if this can be achieved by many feedback loops or complicated loops in the computers and the machines. It would be possible to have a machine computer with consciousness or
which can learn and can go way beyond where we started with it. Is that the question?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is possible. It's possible in principle. And
how far we are from
the we're not that far. In fact, I'm glad you raised the issue because a current buzzword these days is about the so-called singularity, which is the moment in history when we make an artificial intelligence which is smarter than we are. Not than any individual is, but than we as a species, as a civilization are. At which point, according to the aficionados of this, history becomes unpredictable. It's like a singularity in physics. It passed through zero or infinity and who knows what will happen, and people get quite delirious thinking about this. Well has it been called, this is the rapture for nerds. I don't know if you get that. Nobody seems to get that.
The rapture.
The rapture, that's, you know, when the book of Revelation comes true and Armageddon happens and this is the religious idea of the second coming and the end of the world. And this is the rapture for nerds. I think it's not only a foolish idea but a dangerous idea because it deflects our attention from something much more serious, which is going to happen, is happening. And that is that machines that aren't as smart as we are and don't understand what we understand, we're becoming more and more dependent on them, and we're not going to be able to fight free of our dependence on them, and that we're not properly measuring the costs of our increasing dependence. We're overestimating, and we'll even more overestimate the intelligence and the responsibility of the machines that we make. That's what worries me. On that bleak note.
But he also asked whether these machines are going to achieve consciousness.
Oh, sure. Yes. It's impossible in principle, I'm sure, but not very likely in practice, I think, because I think practicality is still going to win. It's possible in principle to make a robotic bird that weighs about as much as this cup, that can fly around in the air and catch insects on the fly and land on a twig. But it would cost billions and billions of dollars. So instead, we're going to make little tiny drones that can't do that but can do things that people are willing to pay for, unfortunately. And I think the same thing is going to be true about artificial intelligence. We're not going to have a conscious doctor, but we're going to have an unconscious medical diagnostic system that has so much credibility that neither the doctors, being responsible agents themselves, being highly responsible and diligent, and the insurance companies are not going to let them overrule the machine. And when that happens, I mean, this will be for good reason. The machines will be provably better at doing medical diagnosis than the individual. It would be irresponsible bravado on the part of the doctor to overrule a machine. So he's not going to do it, or she's not going to do it. But look what that's going to do to the medical profession. It's going to turn doctors, which is a wonderful, wonderful social role today, into a much diminished role. They'll be more like the doorman at a high, you know, at the apartment building. A nice touch, user-friendly, good bedside manner, but just a human interface between the machine and the patient. That's what worries me. Yeah. No, we're the only ones that are immune to that. Hey, that's why we're philosophers. No, some people would say it's already happened. That is to say that some of what passes for the highest and best work in philosophy is really just machine intelligence of a certain sort. I'm teasing, I'm kidding. But no, it's a worry for us all. But now that's getting into the last lecture. We don't want to do that all in advance. Let me try to save something for then.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.